For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Well, well, campers. Welcome back to Camp Duskwood, here on the quiet shores of Twilight Lake. The fire's warm, the night's still, and if you listen real close, you might hear the shadows whispering. I'm Otis Gyre, and tonight I've got two tales that'll take you down haunted paths you'll never want to tread again. Janice, back for the fifth week in a row. You're my most loyal listener, it seems. And Ryan, still holding strong after last week's grim bargains? And who's this new face? Lydia, is it? Welcome to the fire, Lydia. Hope you're not too scared easily, because tonight's stories, well, let's just say they'll make you rethink moving into strange places or taking shortcuts through forgotten roads. Last week, we talked about the circus and a man named Silas Galloway who bit off more than he could chew. And Darren, from week three, I'll bet a few of you have been keeping the lights on since meeting him. But tonight's tales, campers, they'll make you question what follows you home. Or worse, what waits for you to find it. Our first tale tonight is about Jack, a young man looking for a fresh start in a new apartment. But what he finds in his closet isn't old junk or forgotten belongings. It's a suit with a story all its own. And believe me, campers, some suits are better left unworn. Here's The Black Suit by Jeff Sturtevant. Mattress yoked over his shoulders like a man condemned to bear it, Jack Stewart made his way up the final flight of stairs to the fifth floor of the Irving Gardens apartment building. From his pocket dangled the green key fob to his new studio. He dropped the mattress in front of the door, apartment 514, and stuck the key in the corroded old doorknob. It was 5 p.m., a ray of dwindling sunlight cutting down the wall from the window at the end of the hallway. By dark, he should be completely moved in. It was only the bed, a handful of bags, and a celebratory case of bud. He dragged the mattress inside and dropped it in the corner where he figured he'd set up camp. The hollow thump of an empty room, the occasional, seemed effused with a kind of sweet loneliness he both cherished and dreaded. For the first time ever, he was completely on his own. Solitude. Independence. 20 minutes later, he was ascending the stairs with the last of his bags slung over his shoulder. These he dropped in a pile by the mattress, opened one to fish out his pillow, and then he dropped the pillow on the bed and lay down on his back. Looking around, he tried to familiarize himself with the cracks in the bowed plaster ceilings and walls. Warped woodwork painted over so heavily as to fill in the bevels. Somewhere under all that latex was certainly lead. Old transgressions buried forever. After a while, he got up and inspected the bathroom. It looked to have been upgraded sometime in the 70s. He scrutinized the corroded chrome fixtures and flaky grout between the floor tiles. and he turned the toilet's flush lever, but nothing happened. Under the lid of the tank, he saw the chain connecting the lever and flapper had snapped. No luxury accommodations were the Irving Gardens apartments, but for $1 per square foot of personal space, it was surely a bargain. Whatever it took, he'd make it livable. Jack went back to the main room, took a beer out of the case, and popped the top. He began unpacking his things. His only furniture was a table, two chairs, and a dresser. He tucked his shirt and pants in the bottom drawers and his socks and underwear on the top. There was a closet between the front door and bathroom with a dressing mirror hung on the door. He took his coat to the closet, hoping the previous tenant had left him a hanger or two. When he opened it, though, he found more than just a hanger. There was a suit hanging inside. A black jacket and matching pants. That's interesting. He unhooked the suit and brought it out to have a look. He was no expert on formal wear, but he thought the suit looked pretty nice, if not a little out of style. Fine-looking fabric, whatever it was. He checked for the make, but there were no labels in either the collar or the pants. Feeling faintly silly, he brought the jacket to his face and sniffed. It looked brand new, but was a little musty from closet time. Must have been in there for quite a while. Jack hung the suit back up, folded his own jacket, and tucked it up on the top shelf. He fished the business card out of his pocket, the one Al gave him along with the room key earlier in the day. Al was the superintendent, an ex-prize fighter and lifelong handyman in his 70s. He'd been living in and maintaining this building for 40 years. There was a good chance he'd laid down a lot of that lead paint himself. He lost his wife 35 years ago, he'd said. Lived here all alone ever since. He must know who the suit belonged to. It was also a good excuse to summon him about the minor toilet problem. Jack leaned against the closet door and dialed Al's number. "This is Al," the gruff old voice came. "Yes, Jack, the new guy in 514. "Let me guess, the toilet?" Jack chuckled. "So, you already know about it?" "I gotta get to the hardware store. I was gonna quick fix it with a pull chain from the closet light, but I thought better of it." "Hey, speaking of the closet, what's the story with the suit in there, do you know?" "Right, yeah, the suit. Forgot to tell you about that." After a weird little pause, Al cleared his throat. "Just leave it be if it's all the same to you." "Whose is it?" "It isn't exactly anybody's. Just think of it as part of the apartment. Know what I mean?" "Like part of the apartment's history?" Another pause. This one a bit longer. "Yeah, kind of like that. If you could just leave it be, I'd appreciate it. You don't bother it, it won't bother you. Satisfied?" He was anything but satisfied. Al's responses only made him curious, but the conversation was getting uncomfortable, so he decided to let it go. "Fair enough," Jack said. "Thanks, buddy. I'll get to the store tomorrow, probably pick up a bunch of those chains. Seems like everyone's rusting up. Hard water, you know." "Gotcha," Jack said. "Thanks, Al." Jack hung up. He polished off the beer and uncapped a second. Nothing like a few drinks to make you feel more at home, even in a 100-year-old studio with a mysterious suit in the closet. A suit that wouldn't bother him if he didn't bother it. What a mysterious thing to say about a suit. A few beers later, and he was hooking up his VCR to the TV. A box set of Columbo episodes to continue the evening's mystery theme. He unpacked his toiletries, showered, and brushed his teeth. He piled his luggage to make an impromptu sofa and settled in to watch TV. By his side, the empty beer bottles accumulated. 3, 4, 6, 8. The sweet sense of loneliness turning only too sweet. 3 episodes into the first season of Columbo, Jack was snoring soundly into a pile of linens. Jack woke sometime in the night with an odd sense of foreboding. It was quiet in the city streets below. Yellow arc sodium lamplight cast a strange, long shadow across the floor and onto the wall. He turned his head, and he froze. There, in front of the window, stood the form of a headless man. It took him a moment to recognize what he was looking at. It was the suit. The weird old suit from the closet. Standing there like someone was wearing it, like it was looking out the window. Am I daydreaming? Hallucinating? He watched silently, both he and the suit unmoving. It had to be a dream. A drunken, exhausted dream brought on by his uneasiness in the new apartment. But now, he was wide awake. That left hallucinating. Was he a schizo all of a sudden? Should he add that to his list of problems? Or was it a ghost? There's no fucking way, he said. Seizing on the moment of courage, he rolled out of bed and made for the suit. Whether he meant to grab it or tackle it, he didn't even know. He was 21 years old, and he wasn't going to be spooked like a little kid just because he was alone in a new place. He dashed for it, but by the time he got to the window, the suit was lying on the floor, its ghostly contents apparently emptied. It just stood there for a minute, half relieved, half confused, looking down at the crumpled heap. He checked his watch. 3:15 a.m. Don't bother the suit, and it won't bother you, huh? Jack didn't know what the hell had just happened, but this much he did know. The suit bothered him. Jack gathered it up, holding it like something soiled. He opened the door and walked down the hall and stuffed the suit into the trash chute. He shut the door and went back to the apartment and washed his hands in the sink. Feeling silly for doing so, he examined the room for any ghostly ephemera he might have missed. Satisfied, he took one more beer from the case and stood drinking it by the window. He looked outside, saw the dark silhouette of the meat plant on the edge of town, the blinking radio tower, the old billboard overlooking the highway near the police outpost. What the hell had just happened? He sent the empty beer bottle on the windowsill and went back to bed. And eventually, he fell asleep. Jack woke up. The sun was strong in the window. His head throbbed. He checked his watch. 11:30 a.m. It was a minute before last night's episode came to mind. The whole thing felt like a drunken fever dream. How drunk had he been, anyway? Turning to look, he counted the empty beer bottles arranged like bowling pins next to the mattress. All right, so I must have been pretty drunk. Jack peeled himself off the mattress and went to the closet and opened it. There was the suit, hanging where he'd left it yesterday. Just as he'd thought, the whole thing had been a drunken dream. In the wake of it, though, the suit still gave him the creeps. What was it about that thing? Jack showered and dressed and emerged on the city streets in search of a strong cup of coffee. At the local coffee shop around the corner, he saw a familiar face behind a newspaper. It was Al, the super. "Hey, Al," Jack said. Al looked up from his paper. "Hey, buddy. I'll be by later on to fix the flapper. Everything else okay so far?" "Slept pretty bad my first night, but I guess that's to be expected." "Yeah, me too. Al said. Got woke up around 3:15 by someone slamming the trash. Why on earth someone would need to take out the trash at 3 in the morning? That's a mystery to me. Wasn't you, was it, buddy? Nah, Jack said, not me. My apartment's right under there. Work the trash chute that late, and you're sure to wake me up. Something to keep in mind. I'll keep it in mind. Good, Al said. As for the toilet, just give me an hour or two. That's fine, Jack said. Al returned to his paper, and Jack sat at the bar and ordered coffee. He gazed down at the sports section a previous diner had left behind, but he wasn't reading. He was replaying last night's dream in his mind, wherein he actually had used the trash chute at 3:15 a.m. One hell of a coincidence, sure, but that's all it could have been, right? First of all, suits don't just walk out of closets and stand by windows. Second of all, it was right there in the closet. Coincidences happen, Jack thought. A couple hours later, Jack was unpacking the last of his things. There was a knock on the door, and Jack answered it to find Al holding a section of beaded chain and tin snips. Thanks for coming by, Jack said. That's a quick fix, buddy. I'll be out of your way. Right out. Sure thing. Al slowed as he walked by the closet door on the way to the bathroom. He appeared to want to look inside, but stopped himself. The two of them met eyes. So you saw the suit, Al said. Of course, yeah. They'd already discussed it. Why so mysterious about it, if you don't mind me asking? Al gestured as though to brush it off. Nothing mysterious, he said. Like I said, buddy, just leave it be. But why? Al went to the bathroom and lifted the lid off the toilet tank. Was he trying to ignore him? Jack wouldn't have it. He opened the closet and unhooked the suit. Displaying it like a haberdasher, he carried it to the bathroom and cleared his throat so Al would look. He did, with eyes suddenly wide. What are you doing with that? He asked. Didn't I say to leave it be? I don't see the harm in it. Tell me what you know about it. Why not just leave it be? Why are you so insistent that I leave it alone? Is there something about this thing I should know? Al sighed. It was pretty clear Jack wasn't letting this go. Look, I don't want to freak you out, buddy. It's a strange thing, is all. You're not going to freak me out, Jack said. I'm not a kid. I just want to know what the big deal is. Al set down the tin snips and held up his hands in supplication. Fine, he said. You want to know, buddy? I'll tell you. Creakily, the old man sat down on the edge of the bathtub. He regarded the suit in Jack's hands as something fundamentally offensive. It's been here as long as I have, he said. Everyone who ever lived in this room wanted to get rid of it. They'd leave it by my door, throw it out with the trash, whatever. But every time, it'd end up right back in the closet, all by itself. No one knows how or why. Jack paused. That's impossible. You'd think, Al said, but it's the truth. That's why I told you to leave it alone, saving you the trouble of getting spooked when you do the same thing. It's hard enough getting tenants in this old place, and once they get spooked, they all want to run out on me. Jack searched Al's face for signs he was joking, but there were none. He glanced at the suit in his arms, then at the window where he'd imagined it standing in a dream. Then, for the first time, he noticed the empty beer bottle sitting on the windowsill. the one he'd put there before going back to bed. I can't believe it. It really happened? Al seemed to pick up on Jack's inner monologue. You already tried getting rid of it, didn't you? Jack looked back at Al. After a pause, he said, It was me at the trash chute last night. Al let out a little chuckle and shook his head. People tend to be afraid of what they don't understand, but there's no need to be afraid. The suit just belongs in the closet. All you gotta do is leave it there. I guess it just kind of gives me the creeps, Jack said. Oh, I hear you, buddy boy. But the last thing either of us needs to be thinking about is an old suit. So why don't you just hang it up back in there and we'll both put it out of our minds. From now on, just think of it as part of the woodwork. Fair enough? Jack nodded. He returned to the closet and hung the suit back on the rod. It seemed to watch him as he closed the door. Part of the woodwork, he reminded himself. Al fixed the toilet and repositioned the lid. They shook hands and Al left. With that, Jack returned to unpacking. He put on the bedclothes, finished setting up his entertainment center, and unpacked the rest of his toiletries. The suit crept into his mind from time to time, but he forced the thoughts away. Just part of the woodwork. Don't bother the suit. The suit won't bother you. Jack woke in the night to freezing cold. The drapes around the window were billowing in the wind. Had he left it open last night? It was freezing outside. Why would he have opened it in the first place? He threw the covers off, but stopped in his tracks. It was a suit again. It was standing by the side of the bed, not facing the window. This time it was facing him. I'm not drunk, not dreaming, I'm not hallucinating. So what now? What do you want from me? He whispered. At first, nothing happened. But then a kind of airy relaxation seemed to come over the suit, almost like it responded to his voice. What do you want? He asked again. It felt awkward, talking to something he didn't quite believe himself. But again, the suit appeared to respond. The shoulders slumped a bit, the cuffs ruffled. Is there something you want from me? The suit relaxed even more now. Where it had been mannequin stiff a minute ago, it now seemed outsized on something smaller. Gently, it began to drift. The arms folded inward, the pant folded lengthwise, and then bent at the knees. While Jack sat trembling, the suit folded neatly all by itself. Then it drifted slowly onto his lap. Jack didn't move. Moments later, the window began to close, the curtains relaxing on their rods. After that, everything was still. Jack checked his watch. It was 3:21 a.m. Jack looked down at the suit, unsure what to do next. The way it had been presented to him seemed more like a gift than a threat. Was that what it wanted? This ghost, spirit, whatever, to give him the suit? Or was he supposed to do something with it? Put it on? The suit was roughly his size. But what would happen if he put on a haunted outfit? Still, he felt distinctly that this was what it wanted him to do. But why? Should I call Al? He checked his watch again. Bad idea. But there was surely no getting back to sleep tonight. He carried the suit to the table and popped the cap off of a beer and sat drinking. He kept an eye around the room for more ghostly evidence, but it was just him in the suit. A few beers later, his nerves were suitably settled. He stared at the suit, wondering what to do. All right, he said to the empty room. although he knew it wasn't truly empty. With a subtle sensation of being watched, he dropped his shorts, unbuttoned the pants, and slipped them on. He stood and looked down at them. They fit just right, even without a belt. Then he took the jacket, slipped it on, and buttoned it. He looked in the dressing mirror. Not bad, he thought. So what now? He waited for a minute, but nothing happened. Stillness in the room. Nothing ghostly. Nothing revelatory. Starting to unbutton the jacket, he glanced back in the mirror. Well, that's weird. The reflection in the mirror was somehow brighter than the room itself. In the window behind him, the setting sun cast an orange glow. He turned around, but the night was black as ever. But in the mirror, it looked more like late evening. So vain, Charlie. When he turned again, the whole room looked like it did in the mirror. There was a woman there, an attractive brunette in an evening gown. She looked set to go out into town. So did he realized. I'm so happy you came, darling. The woman embraced him, a soft waft of perfume. He embraced her back, but not of his own doing, he realized. He wasn't in control. And the room, he noticed, was nothing like it had been. It looked newer, bright and clean. Wallpaper in place of the old drab paint. Gaudy carpeting over the wide wooden planks. No one happier than me, Doris. I'm the luckiest man alive tonight. The words came out in an unfamiliar voice. It wasn't he who had spoken them. He was inside this man, this Charlie, wearing the same suit. He was just going along for the ride. You just might be, she said. She kissed him. He kissed her back, deeply and passionately. He felt everything. He just wasn't doing it. How long do we have? Charlie asked. I want to cherish every moment. The bastard won't be back until Saturday. I want you with me every moment until then. If he hits you again, Doris, even once, the minute the insurance money comes in, I'll divorce the bastard. Then you'll have me all to yourself. No more sneaking around ever again. I can't stand how he hurts you. How could anyone hurt you? She caressed his face. It won't be long, darling, I promise. Suddenly, there was a ruckus out in the hallway. Both she and Charlie turned their heads. When their eyes met again, there was terror in Doris's face. No, she said. The door crashed open. There was a man in the doorway, a brawny, mustachioed brute in slacks and an undershirt. A little drool in the corner of his mouth. A familiar face. Just much, much younger. It was Al. I knew it, he growled. Al, Doris said. It's not what it looks like. He rushed her. Charlie got between them, but Al caught him on the chin with a vicious punch. Jack felt every bit of it. He felt his knees go weak, heard his ears ringing. You're drunk, Al. Shut up, you cheating tramp. Whore. Al's meaty palm connected with Doris's face with a sound like a thunderclap. Something wet spattered Charlie's face, and he knew immediately it was blood. Doris collapsed bonelessly on the carpet. And you, buddy boy? Charlie got his bearings and threw a punch of his own. Al ducked it. He countered with a hook to the ribs and a brutal cross to the side of his head. Charlie's face hit the floor and the world went dark. Jake woke up to muffled sobs. Whore! Filthy whore! He turned his head. Doris was prone, her face buried in the carpet, a dress torn off and thrown aside. Al on top of her, his pants around his knees, his forearm on the back of her neck. "Get off her," Charlie groaned. "Hey, if it ain't Sleeping Beauty. I'll get off your little girlfriend soon as I'm done with her." Charlie struggled, but he couldn't move. His wrists and ankles were bound with torn strips of Doris's dress. "You son of a bitch! You'll never get away with this." Al only humped her more ferociously, grinding his forearm harder into the back of Doris's neck. A few last thrusts and he ceased his assault. He pushed himself off of her and got to his feet and buckled his pants. Then he wound up a foot and kicked her hard in the side. "Get away with what?" Al asked. "Making love to my own wife? I haven't even gotten started with you yet, buddy." "Just leave her alone, please, Al." Grinning, Al walked to the kitchen area. From the drawer, he extracted a large rolling pin. He weighed it in his hand, gripped it by a handle, and swung it like a bat. Jack's heart and Charlie's heart were one, racing in his chest. "I'll leave the both of you alone. Don't you worry about it. Alone in a goddamn hole. Please, Al, don't do anything you're going to regret."
"Regret?"
He turned to look at his wife, battered and bleeding on the carpet. "Think she regretted all the running around she's been doing? Not until tonight she didn't. I'll bet she regrets it now, though. Don't you think, buddy boy?" "I know what you'd do to her," Charlie said. "You see the cuts, the bruises. How can you blame her for trying to get away from you?"
"She's my property."
Al brought the rolling pin down in the middle of her back with a sickening thwump. Doris screamed. The blow seemed to leave an artificial arch where there wasn't one before.
"Stop, Al!"
He brought it down again, this time on her right shoulder, then again on her left. With each blow, her body was thrown into unnatural contortions. The final blow, the hardest of them all, sunk into the back of her head. Their marriage, along with her agonies, promptly brought to a close.
"Oh, God, Doris!"
Al straightened up, his eyes full of blue insanity. He turned his attention to Charlie. "Till death do us part, right, buddy? Guess that about does it."
"He murdered her."
"Oh, you got it all wrong, buddy. You murdered her. You killed the bitch when you decided to mess with another man's property. And look at what you got yourself into. Now you've gone and killed yourself, too."
Charlie didn't even have time to protest. The rolling pin landed on his back, vertebrae crushed. Again on his ribs. Again on his shoulder. His knees, his elbows, Jack being pummeled, crushed. Only when the final blow came was he delivered from the agony. He saw white, then red, then black. When he awoke again, the pain was gone. It was in the trunk of a moving car. A muffled tune playing over the radio. He smelled excrement, blood. He felt the car turn and the rumble of gravel underneath. Soon it came to a stop. Momentarily, the trunk creaked open. The clear night sky and Al's wild eyes.
"Enjoy the ride, buddy boy."
Charlie didn't answer. He couldn't answer. Jack knew why. Charlie was dead. Jack was alive inside of him, but Charlie was dead. So was Doris. Al seized him by the lapels of his jacket and dragged him out of the trunk, dumped him on the ground. He landed face up. He could make out the car by the back of it, an early 60s Chevy Impala. Al pulled out Doris and dumped her next to him. He just stood there a minute, chest heaving, looking crazily about. He wiped his forehead with the back of his sleeve.
Ladies first. You don't mind, do you, buddy boy?
Al stepped out of Jack's field of vision. He heard Doris's body dragging through the gravel. Dragging. Quieter. Gone. When Al came back, the moon was high in the sky.
Sorry to keep you waiting, buddy boy. How Jack wanted to answer him. He'd never felt so hopeless. Not once in his life. Al lifted his legs and started to drag him. Charlie's head lolled, giving him a different view of his surroundings. Behind the trees to the left, he thought he recognized something. The bulletin board. I think I know where we are. As Al dragged him further along, he tried to picture, from the perspective of his apartment window, where they might be headed. The bulletin board was near the edge of town. The old meat plant was far off to the left. Meanwhile, they were going into the woods. Charlie's head hit something on the ground and turned to the right, giving Jack a different view. Now he could see the blinking red light of the radio tower. The radio tower off to the right. The small patch of woods. We must be. A glimpse of the picnic area confirmed it. Gilbert Park. You should have brought your bathing trunks, buddy boy. Shame about that nice suit. Gilbert Lake. He killed his wife, killed this guy, and dumped them in Gilbert Lake 35 years ago. And the suit, it's Charlie. He's been trying to tell me what happened. Trying to... With the revelation, Jack felt himself slipping away. The last thing he heard were the gentle lapping of water against the bank. Heavy chains on the floor of a boat. Some muffled swear, followed by a comment on Doris's weight. But from all to follow, he'd be spared. He found himself back in front of the mirror in his dark and dingy apartment. Present day. He unbuttoned the jacket, slipped out of it, and let the pants drop to the floor. He turned from the mirror, looked at the spot on the floor where 35 years ago, Doris and Charlie were murdered. He could still see Al on top of Doris, raping her, beating her to death before his very eyes. Even worse, he could still feel the rolling pin crashing into his own back, his own ribs, his own skull. By proxy, Al had killed him too, and he'd gotten away with all of it. Gritting his teeth, Jack picked up his phone and started calling the police. But he stopped. What would he tell them? How could he prove it? There were two bodies in Gilbert Lake. There was no doubt in Jack's mind. But buried in 35 years of silt and sediment. Meanwhile, if he told the cops the truth, they'd throw him in the loony bin. So what was he supposed to do? He checked his watch. 3:30 a.m. The whole thing had taken only minutes. He had truly been transported to another time. All the while, the murderer was sleeping soundlessly downstairs without a care in the world. Sleeping soundly, having not only murdered Doris and Charlie, but also murdered him. Fuck this. Enraged, Jack stormed out into the hall, went into the trash chute, and began slamming the door. Bang! 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 He slammed the door over and over. Slammed it until he heard the footsteps in the stairwell. Kept slamming until he saw the murderer's silhouette in the moonlit window at the end of the hallway. Jack! Are you out of your mind? I know what you did, Jack said, leveling a finger at the man. What are you talking about?
Jack took a few steps toward him.
You beat them to death. You dumped them in the lake.
By now, a couple of the other tenants were standing in their doorways. It appeared none of them dared to interfere. Charlie and Doris, Jack went on. I know everything. I felt everything. The rolling pin, the Chevy Impala. I know where the bodies are, Al. The jig's up. Al's chest was rising and falling rapidly. His face, though, had turned from despondent to defeated. The suit, huh? Charlie's suit, Jack said. It showed me. It showed me everything. A pause. The tenants stood wide-eyed in the doorways. Al looked down.
Well, I'll be damned, he said. I should have known that bastard could do more than just reappear. Hell, I'd have kept that room myself if I knew it. Damn suit just gave me the creeps.
How could you have done that? You murdered them, Al.
You got no idea what you put me through, Jack. The cheating, the running around. I was just so angry.
You beat her, Jack said. You beat her, you raped her. And you killed her, and I can prove it. It's over, buddy boy.
Al was pacing the end of the hallway.
You know, after 35 years, you think you're pretty much home free, he chuckled, ironically. But a fellow my age ain't exactly fit for prison. Another door opened then. At least 5 sets of eyes on Al now. Jack was grateful for them, in case the desperate old man decided to try something.
You shouldn't complain, though, Al continued. I had a good run while it lasted. There's just one more thing you need to know. Something I'm sure old Charlie didn't tell you.
What's that? Jack asked.
Toilet chains are in my desk. Help yourself.
With that, the old man turned and ran for the window.
Stop! Shouted Jack. But it was too late. He crashed through the glass head first.
When Jack reached the window, he saw the broken, writhing figure 5 floors below, blood gathering in a pool around him, his arms and legs broken and bent at odd angles. He remembered the way Doris looked after he'd beaten her. 35 years it took, but Al had proved Charlie right. In the end, he would regret it.
It took Al 2 hours to die, but die he did. With no family or relatives to vouch for him, his body ended up in a cemetery for the unclaimed. Old transgressions buried forever. All set up in the apartment now, Jack popped a beer and sat on the couch. The suit was hanging back in the closet where it belonged. He could get rid of it if he wanted to, he knew. With Charlie's soul at rest, there'd be no reason for it to come back again. It was all right, though. The suit no longer gave him the creeps. No more walking around the apartment at night, bedside visits, etc. He'd even have it cleaned. History aside, after all, it was a pretty nice suit. Some suits just beg to be worn, Jack thought.
Well, campers, how's that for a moving day surprise? I'll bet Jack won't be forgetting that apartment anytime soon. And Janice, tell me, do you ever feel like an old piece of clothing might be watching you? What about you, Lydia? Think you'd keep something like that in your closet? No? Smart move. Some things are best left to their rest. Speaking of rest, our next story is about a couple who should have let a road stay forgotten. But they didn't. And the road? It didn't forget them. Our second tale tonight is about Randy and Julia, two adventurers with a love for the macabre. But when their curiosity takes them to a legendary abandoned highway, they learn the hard way that some roads lead only one place, straight to hell. Here's Broken Down Road by Brian Martinez. Randy and Julia loved dead things. They craved nothing as much as they did abandoned towns, places built by man and then left to be taken back by nature. Shut down factories and decommissioned prisons were their playgrounds, and they collected ghost stories like some people collect baseball cards. Other couples called them morbid, of course, and their families thought they were crazy. But they never felt as peaceful, never felt as at home as when they picnicked in a cemetery or walked hand in hand in a crypt, reading aloud the names of the deceased to each other. So, when it came time to plan a vacation for their 3-year anniversary, it didn't take long to decide on a week-long road trip, an adventure to some of America's forgotten places. Their plan was to start at Pithole City, then drive to Centralia, then into Penn Hills Resort, with a handful of other stops along the way, culminating in fulfilling their lifetime dream of doing a little time at Eastern State Penitentiary. They packed some clothes, loaded up Randy's Oldsmobile, and headed out on their adventure. They'd been driving quietly for the last hour or so, barely seeing another car the entire time, and had fallen into a peaceful silence. Sometime after passing their third state forest, a place where things had the nerve to be alive and boring, Julia was staring out the window at the moonlit highway, daydreaming about one day visiting Highgate Cemetery in London, when something caught her attention. She sat up in the passenger seat and turned to Randy, eyes lit up with excitement. "Did you see that?" "See what?" He glanced over at the rearview mirror. "Just trust me. Pull over." Randy slowed down and rolled onto the shoulder, careful not to run over the lost hubcap there. "What is it?" he asked, confused by her sudden change in mood. "Have you heard of Broken Down Road?" she asked not so innocently. Randy scoffed at the odd question. "Of course." "Well," she paused, "I think I saw an exit back there." He looked at his phone mounted to the dashboard. The GPS showed only a straight line indicating the highway they were on. No turns, no exits. Not so much as a dot in the road. "That's supposed to be way further south from here," he said. "True, but no one can ever find it, right? Maybe because they're looking in the wrong place." He frowned. He'd read the stories about Broken Down Road, which, despite its nickname, was more of a local highway than a road. 30 years earlier, it had been the site of an accident so deadly that drivers, locals especially, refused to use it anymore, forcing it to be abandoned within 5 years' time. Stories of what happened there grew into myths, replaced by rumors of missing tourists who came seeking the legendary road. Locals allegedly grew so concerned about Broken Down Road that they took matters into their own hands and concealed the entrance, turning the unfindable road into a legend overnight. Randy was skeptical, but he also knew himself. If he didn't take a look now, he would end up going mad, driving up and down the highway, looking for a hidden entrance for the next 10 years. So he shifted the Oldsmobile into reverse and slowly backed up along the shoulder, running over a few rocks and some trips of torn tire rubber, not stopping until Julia told him to stop. He didn't know how she'd seen it. The trees were so thick, the weeds so overgrown, they were choking each other out. But there, between 2 sickly elm trees, was a space little more than a car's length. Cracked blacktop branched away from the well-maintained highway, leading into the night-heavy woods. "That could be any road," Randy said. Julia smiled, pointing to his phone. Regardless of what road it was unmarked. They looked at one another, not saying a word, until Randy slowly smiled back at her. 10 minutes, he said. "If we don't see a way off, we turn around." I know the rules, my dear. I made the rules. With another smile and a glance back to make sure no cars were coming, he swung out wide and steered the Oldsmobile into the space between the trees. Dead branches scraped their doors on either side, fingernails dragging on a chalkboard. The beaten-up blacktop was louder under the car's tires, and the headlights barely pierced 20 feet through the darkness. But Randy kept his foot steady on the gas, pushing the car up the slow incline of an overgrown ramp, the oppressive plant life crowding them the entire way. They shared a breathless minute, dried leaves scratching along the Oldsmobile's roof, but at the end of it they were greeted by a beautiful sight. An empty road stretched into the night, lit by nothing more than the stars and moon above.
"It can't be,"
Randy said under his breath. Julia reached out and squeezed his leg, barely able to contain her excitement.
"One way to find out, right?"
"I guess so," he said, and pressed down on the gas. The road was surprisingly smooth compared to the ramp they'd taken to reach it. The blacktop was in good condition, with only a few cracks and potholes to speak of. Randy was careful to drive around them, maintaining a low speed, despite his urge to open up on the road, where no one was there to stop him. Their adventure had taken an exciting, unexpected turn, and yet something bugged him about the situation. Julia, who'd been taking picture after picture on her phone, felt his hesitation and asked him what was wrong.
"How is this so easy to find?" he asked.
"I mean, if it is broken down road." Julia thought about it, her phone lowering. "Well, there were some really bad storms around here a few days back. Maybe they uncovered the entrance."
"Well, maybe," he said,
still not convinced. And yet the question moved quickly to the back of his mind as he looked around at the treasure they'd uncovered, their hidden playground. The road looked as if it hadn't been visited by a single soul in decades, not until they stumbled across it. There was no divider to speak of, only a faded line at its center, little more than a whisper of white reflected in the car's headlights. An impenetrable wall of trees crowded either side of the road, guarding the road, and them, from sight.
"I think there's a river pretty close to here," he said, squinting through the trees.
"A hitchhiker drowned in it a while back." As his eyes adjusted further down the road to a shape just barely visible in the distance, he heard Julia say something.
"That's weird. My phone just shut off," she mumbled to herself.
But Randy couldn't pay attention to her just then, because his focus was on the outside of the car. Outside and a bit further down. About 100 yards ahead of them, a man stood perfectly still at the center of the road. As Julia struggled with her phone, trying to get it to turn on again, Randy let his foot off the gas and let the car coast. He wanted to say something to Julia, but he didn't want to scare her. The man in the road remained still, either oblivious to the car or standing in defiance of it. Closer now, Randy could see that the man was facing away from them. He wore a dark suit with red shoes, a collar of a shirt sticking up from the jacket. Only 20 yards away from him now, Randy brought the car to a complete stop. Julia looked up from her dead phone. "What are you?" she started saying, but her voice cut out when she saw the man in the road. Not moving, not facing them, not doing anything but blocking their way.
"Randy?" she said.
"I know."
"No. He might need help."
"Randy?"
she repeated, her voice quivering this time.
"Look at his feet."
He looked and immediately wished he hadn't. Randy had thought the man was wearing red shoes, but in fact, he wasn't wearing shoes at all. His feet were bare, no shoes or socks on them. The skin had been shorn clean off, leaving a mixture of raw muscle and bloody flesh, pink and white and puddled red.
"Call the police,"
he said quietly. Just as she did, the phone shut off as well. Randy ripped it from its mount and pressed the power button.
then gave it an angry shake, but it remained powerless, the screen dark and cold.
"You need to get us out of here," Julia said. Her body twisted toward him, eyes wide open, pleading.
The surprise stop had taken a bad turn, and their adventure was suddenly no longer fun. They either needed to keep going or turn around. Anything but sit in the middle of an abandoned road and stare at a man with skinless feet.
"Where'd he go?"
Randy asked. Julia snapped forward in her seat, seeing what Randy saw. The man was gone. He vanished, leaving behind two perfectly formed footprints in the middle of the road, both painted in dark red blood. A blink later, those were gone too. Randy felt it before he saw it. The face in the driver's side window, half red, half white, the left side torn clear off. Julia screamed. The sound was deafening in the confined space. Randy fumbled so hard for the gas he missed the pedal, the shoe slipping off, then aimed again and stomped it like he meant to crush it. The car lurched forward, rocketing away from the man with half a face. Julia looked back and shouted something like, "Oh, God, he's not alone!" Except Randy barely heard anything but the heartbeat pummeling his eardrums. His knuckles were white as he squeezed the steering wheel and tried to keep control of the car, pushing its old, whiny engine as hard as it would go.
"What the hell was that?"
Julia asked, tears choking her vision.
I don't know,
was all Randy could think to say. He looked in the rear view, then the side view, but saw nothing except the darkened road slipping past. No bloody footprints, no man with half a face. They tried to calm themselves, come up with a plan. They would drive as long as it took to find the next exit, they decided. No turning back. No slowing down for anything short of a brick wall. Randy wanted to ask what she'd meant by, "He's not alone," but decided against it. He caught his breath and checked his time, trying to make sense of it all. The clock in the Oldsmobile's dashboard read 9:26. As he watched, the display dimmed for a moment, blinked all zeros, then returned to normal. He was about to ask Julia if she'd seen it too when the wheel seized in his hands. It felt like someone had grabbed the wheel and was trying to pull it away from him. The car lurched left, then right, as Randy fought for control. He tried to hit the brakes, but the pedal didn't budge under his foot. The car careened down the dark road, the headlights swaying left and right in the night as Randy wrestled with the wheel. He saw a line of trees up ahead, drawing closer every second, and knew in his bones, that whatever he was fighting with wanted them to meet those trees, to impale the car on them. His hand clenched the wheel, arms shaking from using all of his strength. He started to think he needed to brace for impact, to prepare for the unavoidable. Before he knew what was happening, Julia took off her seatbelt, reached over, and turned the key in the ignition. With the engine cut, the Oldsmobile coasted along the road, the wheel still pulling them left and right, until finally they crawled to a stop at a harsh angle, halfway between lanes. Randy and Julia watched the steering wheel turn on its own for a few seconds, still trying to make them crash before finally falling still. Then they looked at each other. Both of them were sweaty and pale, both breathing heavily, both looking as if they were about to throw up.
"That's good thinking," he said, and she blinked.
Thanks.
"What did you mean back there when you said he wasn't alone?"
The car came alive with the sound of fists pummeling the glass. There was no one around them, no one on any side of the car, and yet it sounded like a crowd was beating the windows and kicking the doors, an angry mob trying to rip them out of the car. Randy checked the door locks as Julia covered her ears, trying to shut out the din of furious smashing and screaming. Randy looked around, assessing the situation. They were trapped, really trapped. Turning the car on meant crashing. Staying there meant being attacked by an unseen horde. Getting out meant, well, he wasn't about to get out, not any time soon. Not while the pounding and scratching continued. The best option, the only option, was to wait out the attack. He distantly remembered how he used to like dead things, but that idea seemed about a million miles away just then, or however far they'd traveled down Broken Down Road. Then he heard it. The unmistakable crack of glass. "There!" Julia shouted, pointing at the hairline fracture in the rear windshield. As unseen fists continued to beat on the car, the crack grew longer and longer, branching off like arteries until the whole sheet threatened to smash in. Randy stared at Julia, not knowing what to do. "Just go," she said. "Anything's better than here." There was no time to argue. The rear windshield collapsed inward, a million bits of safety glass exploding across the rear seats. Randy twisted the key, turning the old engine over on the first try, and floored the gas pedal, getting them the hell out of there. A quick glance at the mirror revealed a swarm of bloody hands being pulled from the missing windshield. He was thrilled to find the steering wheel was completely under his control this time, and Julia was, too, as she let out a small, nervous laugh. In no time, they were speeding back down Broken Down Road, away from the things that wanted to be in with them, the night wind whipping through their car from the missing rear windshield. Their hair and clothes flapped and waved as they careened along the long-lost highway. "Do you see an exit?" Julia asked over the sound of the wind assailing them. I think I see something," he said, straining to see in the lightless night. But then he smelled something, too, something overpowering, like blood mixed with earth, and before he knew it, the hands were on him, cold hands covering his eyes, choking him from behind, scratching and pulling at his face. He tried to tear them away, but it was too late. He felt the car leave the highway, tires bouncing on unpaved ground, and then, just for a moment, with fingernails pulling at his eyes, he heard Julia scream. Randy felt the impact in his chest as the seatbelt engaged like a punch to the sternum. Then his ears were filled with the sound of breaking glass and crunching metal. The world folded in around them. The hands on his face disappeared as quickly as they came, leaving him to gasp for breath as his vision came back, and the car now settled into its new mangled shape. Blinking, shaking his head, Randy studied the passenger seat next to him for some time, trying to make heads or tails of it. So many things had been appearing and disappearing that night, he thought it was another trick of the light. Maybe damage to his brain, sustained from the crash. Maybe even the thick smoke exhaling from the dashboard that was choking him, making him delirious. Because something about the passenger seat didn't make sense. It was empty. Julia was gone. He didn't know whether to trust his own eyes or even his mind. Had she not been with him on the trip? Were his memories of talking with her and being next to her all false? Just more damage from the crash? But there was one sight, one image that brought everything into instant, painful focus. Her seatbelt. She'd taken it off before the crash. Randy became aware of a cold draft whispering across his face. He turned his sore neck to look at the windshield, at the massive hole in the passenger side. Then he looked through it, through the billowing smoke rising from the car's hood, into the woods beyond. There, at the foot of a moss-covered pine, Julia lay face up, arms at her sides, as simply as if she were reclined on their couch back home. "Oh, my God," Randy said over and over, clawing his way out of his seatbelt and forcing open his crumpled door. He ran to her, mumbling prayers the whole way until it collapsed in the dead leaves next to her and shook her, the breath caught in his chest as he prayed and shook and prayed and shook. Slowly, she opened her eyes. It was a miracle, and he laughed. She sat up, spiting him telling her not to, and she looked around at the woods, then at the highway, as if she'd never seen them before. The smell came again to Randy's nose, the smell of death. Then he saw the faces in the trees staring at them, emerging from the shadows of the pines.
Even though he knew he shouldn't move someone so soon after an accident, he decided the alternative was much worse. He helped Julia to her feet and brought her up onto the paved road, leaving behind the ruined Oldsmobile. With an arm around her waist, he started walking her down the highway, away from the people coming from the trees and the others in the road, some with missing arms, some with burnt clothes and skin. He didn't know how long it would be until the next exit, but he wasn't going to stop until they reached it. The burnt and bleeding crowd shuffled slowly behind, though he tried not to look at them. After a few minutes of painful walking, Randy heard a sound through the trees on the other side of the highway. It took some time to place it, but soon he realized what it was. The river, the one they'd talked about earlier. It was close by, closer than the exit that wouldn't come. And then something kicked in the back of his mind, a tiny thought, a single fact, repeated in so many of the million ghost stories he'd read and collected over the years. An ancient, time-tested rule to offer protection from the dead. "Running water," he shouted proudly. "They can't cross it." He didn't wait for Julia to agree with him. He just grabbed her hand and started running toward the river, weaving between trees and jumping over rocks. Julia kept up, letting herself be pulled toward what might be their only escape. She didn't complain about her injuries or let them slow her down. Before long, they emerged from the other side of the trees to find a wide river rushing through the moonlit night. It was swollen from the recent storms, the waters flowing dangerously fast, threatening to carry them or anyone away with one misstep. Randy let go of Julia's hand so he could step in properly before turning back to help her. The water was frigid, soaking his shoes and pants instantly. "Come on," he called out, breath already shaking. "They're coming." From the woods, emerging from between the old knotted trees that held back the waterlogged shoreline, broken bodies stepped into the moonlight. A woman in a faded yellow dress, burnt a little more than charcoal from the waist up. An older man, a truck driver from the look of his clothes, with a horribly broken neck that allowed his bloodied head to flop around. Two little children, one boy and one girl, whose shattered bodies barely held them up on blackened legs. Standing in the bitterly cold water, the heat draining from his body, Randy had a thought so strange, so foreign, it was as if it weren't his own. As if he'd turned into a hidden radio frequency, a code buried in the airwaves. It was thought that Broken Down Road had been so easy for them to find that night for a reason. Because they hadn't found it. Rather, it had found them. It had appeared to them by its own choice, by its own volition. The playground, seeking the toys. Body temperature dropping, blood going cold. Randy understood the truth of Broken Down Road. It was always easy to find when it wanted to be found. He shouted for Julia to get into the water as more and more destroyed people came out of the trees. Julia, beaten up badly from the crash, stood above him in the night, pale and beautiful and his to protect. And yet she didn't move, didn't join him in the freezing cold water. She didn't even look scared anymore, just bloodied and discolored. He looked down at his hand, the one he'd been offering to her, and saw how much of her blood was on it. Cold and coagulated. As Randy looked back up and watched his hands reach out for him, Julia among them, her bloody fingers beckoning him to come back to rejoin her and the others on land, he suddenly knew the truth, that she couldn't set foot in the river, couldn't even touch it. The dead couldn't cross running water, and soon neither could he.
Well, now, what'd I tell you? Broken Down Road doesn't just find you, it keeps you. Makes you wonder how many more it's called over the years, doesn't it? Lydia, you still with us? Thought I might have lost you there for a second. And Ryan,
You looked like you were about to pack up and head for the hills during that one.
Don't worry. The road won't find you. Not unless you go looking for it.
Well, campers, that's it for tonight. Thanks for joining me, Janice, Ryan, and Lydia. Next week, I've got more tales to chill your bones and keep you up at night. And remember, you never know what might be lurking just out of sight, or what's waiting for you to find it.